Hello, I'd like to call this public meeting of the Oregon Board of Forestry to order. First, perform the roll call. Nils Christofferson.
Here.
Cindy Deacon-Williams.
Here.
Joe Justice.
Here.
Jim Kelly.
Here.
Brendan McComb.
Here.
Mike Rose.
Here.
I'm Tom Imeson. I'm here. So we're all here today for the meeting. As a reminder, this public meeting will be live streamed, or at least attempted to be, all day. It would be helpful for people to silence their electronic devices for the duration of the meeting. In addition, in order to ensure that the board has the opportunity to conduct all the business on the agenda for its meetings, public comment for agenda items will be limited to no more than 30 minutes and received upon conclusion of the topic's presentation. A sign-up sheet is available for public comment on a first-come, first-served basis. We'll first proceed with the consent agenda. Is there a motion for approval of consent items A through D?
So moved.
Moved by Mike. Is there a second?
Second.
Joe seconded first, so we'll take that second. And note that you would have seconded it had the need be. Is there any objection to approval of those minutes then? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And we'll next go to State Forester Doherty. I guess we need to also approve the minutes from the September 4th meeting. So before we do that, any objection to those minutes? Yeah, I just see it differently on here. So if we're done, we're done with that. And then Peter, we'll go ahead with you.
Great. Good morning. I have three topics to cover this morning. The first is sort of key takeaways from the Board of Forestry October retreat. The second is our fire financial situation. And the third is a quick update on our climate change work. The board had a very productive and thoughtful conversation at their October retreat, and I think there are key takeaways in three main areas: structural and operational processes, working relationships and decision making, and strategic planning or the forestry program for Oregon. In terms of structural and operation processes, the board indicated a desire to have greater control and flexibility in agenda setting, in mid-course correction to work plans. We discussed how board members can add items to the agenda over the course of the year, and what, if any, principles does the board want around agenda setting. Members did acknowledge that if any two board members request a topic for inclusion on the agenda, it will get added. Discussion about meeting agenda should allow adequate time for discussion and decision, not be loaded with updates. And we also discussed structuring the agenda with decision items at the front end of the agenda, and we will do that. We discussed building in space for agenda planning, for discussing process improvements and unforeseen substantive issues, while mapping out key policy and concerns and priorities for each division in the two-year cycle. I'll come back to that later in my comments. The board also discussed avenues for department staff to formally check in with the board to provide an outlook on completion of ongoing work related to an agenda topic. You know, really bringing the idea is the feasibility of the resulting work, will it meet board direction? And or will it be productive for board decision making? And so we'll work on that. We discussed giving staff clear direction. It was suggested that the chair synthesize the status of discussions to wrap up each topic, providing a general summary of the discussion and any conclusion, decision, and next step actions. This approach would allow for review for accuracy by board members and give staff a chance to clarify their understanding of board guidance and decisions. And the board finally expressed a desire to find more opportunities for awareness building and deliberation on complex issues with more frequent status reports from agency staff prior to getting the recommendations. including checks for shared understanding or clarification needed with regards to guidance from the board, and allow more time for the board to deliberate towards consensus building rather than taking a quick vote on issues. In terms of working relationships and decision-making, the board discussed how attitudes have shifted or are less aligned on difficult decisions. Board dynamics are changing, especially with the recent addition of three new members. Relational trust is built over time, and there was recognition that it's difficult to cultivate within a public forum. There was also discussion around instances where staff recommendations and board decisions do not align, which can create tension. And mentioned exploring opportunities for board members to gain familiarity with each other and with department staff to develop meaningful relationships. We discussed how the board can build consensus and make timely decisions. Ideas were shared for being intentional in work planning about how much time is needed to gather information and deliberate on a key policy issue, and then throughout the year, finding flexibility where possible when more time is needed or desired by the board on a decision. Conversely, the board should recognize when a delay in a decision actually is a decision. And then finally, in building recommendations, we discussed revisiting and clarifying a shared understanding between the board and the executive team about expectations for staff work on information gathering, analysis, and option building for board decision on a given policy issues. And we even discussed what is a recommendation. Is it just a first draft? Is it a policy option among alternatives or a departmental proposal? So I think those are all things that we can continue to work on during the year. We also discussed the forestry program for Oregon, mainly focused around values and the use of public values in decision making. There seemed to be a desire to update and codify the value section, particularly during this transitional period with board membership. And I think that discussion had an eye on creating a utility for this board and future boards' use in decision making. One suggestion was to examine the suite of values as a whole and set intentions around the right balance. Another one was to review public survey on values and use this to inform updates. The board, some other board comments on the values at the retreat, including focus on what has changed from 2011 when it was last done to now, such as how population expansion, fire season, and climate change affects public social economic interest. Climate change impacts need to be called out as integral to all forest management values, including Oregon's unique role in storing carbon. With a decline in harvest related to federal forest management investments, how are the broader goals of forestry, the forestry program for Oregon, affected? Being specific about the definition of active management and which forests are best suited for active management, and discussed expansion on the types of management, whether active, passive, or inactive. Also discussed adaptive management, climate refugia, federal regulatory changes, fire and state lands management need to be considered when updating the values. Finally, at the end of the retreat, the board discussed the department's strategic initiatives, the board work plans, and topics that could be brought to the board. In addition to ongoing work, board members discussed including compliance audit design for the annual monitoring report, creating administrative rules that include multiple species, review all the FPA rules, determine which may need to be updated in light of new scientific information on climate change, work on a legislative concept for trust land transfer from an agency perspective. More information around half staffing levels may impact the each level of the three-tiered state forest long-term financial projections. a financial dashboard design to ensure it has what the board really wants in terms of tracking our finances, reporting on the number of public information requests, workload impacts, and the number of FTE performing the work, looking at good neighbor authority program progress and status, and discussion around developing policy guidance, moving from a pilot to an operational program. Discuss the opportunity to think about incorporating climate change and logistical planning, how it relates to the forestry program for Oregon, and a desire to see climate change implications in all work. So moving forward, the next step in your planning process will occur at the January board meeting. So I'll be working with division chiefs and program directors to incorporate current and potential agenda topics into your work plans. The board will review draft work plans, and just looking at it, given the number of topics, the board's going to have to set priorities in January. And then based on board priorities and input, we will revise the proposed work plans, and we're scheduled to bring those back to the March meeting where the board will revise again and or approve them. And these are the work plans that set the agenda for the next biennium so that we have a thoughtful planned agenda. We can still make mid-course adjustments or mid-year changes to the agenda along the way. But this is the board process for saying what are we going to be focused on for the next 2 years. Moving on to fire finance, the last 8 years of increased severity, complexity, and duration of fire season have revealed two related financial challenges facing Oregon's wildfire response system. The first is a structural problem leading to cash flow challenges funding wildfire response. And the second is an increase in financial and administrative workload leading to delays in collecting wildfire accounts receivable from other parties, primarily the federal government. Oregon's large fire funding structure was designed for the average fire season of a decade ago. Under our current structure, the department starts the fire season with $10 million in cash on hand for fire suppression cost. These funds come from the landowner fees paid to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. And this approach worked fine when our average gross cost for fighting fires was $10 million or less, which it was prior to 2013. Since 2013, the average gross fire cost has exceeded $60 million a year, creating a cash flow issue until the other revenue sources, general fund, other agency billings, FEMA, catastrophic insurance, and responsible party recoveries can be collected. Given these large fire seasons that have been occurring back to back, the department has been addressing annual cash shortfalls through interfund borrowing from the treasurer. As fires increase, so has the volume of transactions that ODF staff are processing. The 2016 Secretary of State audit found on average that the number of quarterly transactions for personal services and supply, and capital outlays increased from about 40,000 to over 100,000 in the 2013-2015 fire season. In addition to the increasing number of transactions, the financial and administrative aspects of large fires are also more complex to process. For example, more fires are occurring between multiple fire districts and jurisdiction, and involve multiple levels of government. This workload has impacted the ability to timely process wildfire accounts receivables from other parties. Following the 2016 audit, ODF made some business processes and staffing improvements to address this. We reconfigured our fire finance procedures with the goal of significantly decreasing the time between our expenditures of funds and when we receive reimbursements. We implemented that in 2018. Working with federal partners to expedite recovery of high dollar value receivables first, rather than first in, first out, and increasing staffing levels to work through delayed collection processes and bringing invoices up to date. In 2018, we had a $100 million fire season in terms of gross cost. These costs occurred in the last year of the biennium when available cash was at its lowest, requiring the department to secure a second line of credit from the Treasury. This situation was coupled in delays collecting the $60 million in receivables in 2018, as well as carrying the cost of previous fire seasons. The department did not have the cash available to pay off one of the lines of credit. This near default has brought a great deal of attention to the agency's financial situation, which most recently resulted in Governor Brown's establishing a forestry financial oversight team. This team is comprised of key leadership from the governor's office, the Department of Administrative Services, ODF, the Board of Forestry, and the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response. The team is charged with receiving reports from an independent contractor who will be hired to provide services to address the backlog of receivables within the Department of Forestry and to provide recommendations for structural changes to expedite standardizing processes of financial transactions associated with wildfire costs. And secondly, evaluate options for a financial structure for managing our seasonal borrowing to support wildfire response. The team's work is expected to last approximately 6 months. The independent contractor procurement and management will be handled by the Department of Administrative Services. And by addressing the current financial situation and creating a new structure and processes that reflect the reality of increasing and costly wildfires, the team's work will enable ODF to refocus its resources and efforts to the core vital work of fighting fires to protect Oregonians and the state's natural resources into the future. I will be providing regular updates on the team's work to the board, department staff, and our key stakeholder groups. And final topic on climate change. On October 29th, we release a first comprehensive report on the stock and flux of forest carbon. It's titled the Oregon Forest Ecosystem Carbon Inventory from 2001 to 2016. This report, we've presented to the board drafts of this, is based on extensive field plots, supplies the quantitative dimension of a forest carbon accounting framework by providing estimates for the status and trends of carbon in Oregon's forest ecosystem and ownerships since 2001. As we've mentioned during board presentations, we've been working with California, Washington, and British Columbia to develop a consistent carbon accounting framework and to collaborate on research topics. We recently formalized this relationship by signing a memorandum of understanding on Pacific Coast temperate forest with those other three governments. And I'm providing a copy of that MOU for your reference. So, thanks, and I'll be glad to answer any questions. There's also a slightly more detailed summary of the financial fire finance situation for your reference.
Questions for Peter or comments? I have
another
question.
thanks, Tom. I had the chance to attend the combined meeting of the Oregon Board of Agriculture and the EQC Commission on September 26th. They met in Madras and discussed water quality roles and responsibilities of ODA and the DEQ. And of course, temperature was discussed. I found it interesting that ODA struggles with past practices and resulting conditions of streams, just as we do in forestry. It doesn't appear that they really have a desired future condition target like ODF does to try to address that issue. So I found it as a forester interesting. Of course, they talked about TMDL plans. It was pretty specific to that area around Madras, the Deschutes Basin, and so on. But the discussion was really about an entire basin and how the DEQ thinks about temperature related to those TMDL plans. They talked a lot about reasonable assurance and accountability of the TMDL plans and how we are showing progress towards addressing temperature. And of course, the lands we regulate would be a part of that reasonable assurance. And the rules and the protection measures that we currently have today or the rules that we would be taking up in the future. Of course, the DEQ is considering shade and flow and stream width, how all of these land uses, ag, urban, forestry, all combine and impact temperature. There's a lot of discussion related to, of course, agriculture and the use of moving water out for irrigation and the things that they can do to increase flow associated with that. And they're doing a lot, of course, the Department of Ag's doing a lot of incentivizing and good work to try to increase flow. You're probably aware that, you know, I know you're aware that Tom and Peter and Kyle and I are meeting regularly with the EQC members. Wade Mosby is here today, member of the EQC commission, liaison to this board as I'm the liaison to their commission. And I guess I want to say I really appreciate the commitment of the EQC members and both the DEQ and the Department of Forestry's commitment to working together to really find solutions to this problem. And, you know, we've set up meetings, quarterly meetings of that group moving forward throughout the year. And so I expect to have a lot of great discussion related to that. A couple of things I've asked just as a board member for information for myself of Kyle. I've asked because we're talking about the Siskiyous rural analysis and the Siskiyous. I'm trying to understand the TMDL overlay in the Siskiyous, what streams are that we regulate, what the land uses are, how much is federal, how much is agriculture, how much is a part of our what we regulate. Trying to understand that. I'm also trying to understand system potential shade. And how that relates to DFC, desired future condition. I also there they one of the presenters gave a paper that was kind of interesting that was basically looking at a question of can restoration work on temperature impaired streams could that offset potential increased temperature as a result of climate change. And it was interesting for a couple of reasons. It was on the Grand Ronde River in Catherine Creek, which I'm very familiar with. Nils is very familiar with in my neck of the woods. So I'm really familiar with the study and the areas. Those streams cross multiple land uses. In fact, the lands that I work on and manage, we have tributaries of Catherine Creek that are on the lands that I work on and am responsible for. I forwarded that paper to Brenda. I was curious as to Brenda's input on that. I got some great input from Brenda. And so I think I'm not sure how we use that kind of information, but it's what we're grappling with. And so an interesting paper. And I'll forward it to Hillary and as for information to other board members to take a look at. I really do believe the work between the DEQ and the Department of Forestry, I'm optimistic that it'll be complementary to our rural analysis in the Siskiyou, and I'm really optimistic about the outcome of it. Thanks.
Great, thank you. Any other? Yes, Brenda.
Maybe that's a good segue to a meeting that I attended, excuse me, last month, the OED meeting in Condon, Oregon, where the board distributed available funds to projects all around the state, many of which were kind of focused on restoration of streamside systems. So in addition to that, though, there was a pretty robust discussion about committee structure for OWEB. And two areas struck me as possible areas of coordination or collaboration with this board and maybe other state boards, too. One was with climate change, and OWEB is very serious about taking that on as kind of a core theme for what they do. The other was around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so the discussion was, should there be separate committees that deal specifically with these issues, or should those issues be integral to all the things that OWEB does across all areas of their mission? And so I'm not sure that there's been a decision. I can't recall if there was a decision made yet, but But I think those two areas are areas that overlap significantly with what we are addressing too. And so some type of collaboration or coordination seems important.
Thank you.
So maybe that's something that we can bring to the board. So we collaborate across the natural resource agencies, and we're currently working on the updating Oregon's climate adaptation framework. And we just had a meeting about governance for that because there's 23 agencies involved. DLCD is leading that. OWEB's one of the core partners. We're proposing that the governance will be the natural resources directors to serve as an executive team for the core team of staff that are working on it. We have one person on that core team working on forest adaptation. And then the other thing that it would be great to continue discussion on is diversity, equity, inclusion. And I serve on the diversity, equity, inclusion subcommittee for Oregon's executive leadership team. We're talking about a statewide push for some additional investments, that if the state's really committed to diversity, equity, inclusion, there's probably warrant some investment in the diversity, equity, inclusion office. And, many state agencies were not funded for a position for diversity, equity, inclusion. And many other state agencies, mid-size and smaller, don't have that capacity. So questions around how do you get that capacity to really make a commitment to that, I think will be an important conversation among all state agencies going forward. So I think I'll continue to work with OWEB on seeing where we can coordinate among boards.
Jim.
Yeah, I also have a report. It's feeling a little bit like grade school. I went down a couple of weeks ago to tour the Green Diamond Resources property near Klamath Falls. Kyle and Chad from ODAF came as well. And that property is participating in the cap and trade program of California. And it was very educational, nothing like a field trip to see that on the ground. That very large property had previously been owned by a company that had over-harvested significantly, and so that's what Green Diamond ended up with a large property with a lot of small trees. So the choices that they've made have been very rational for them to participate in this program and to see what will be win-wins for in many different directions at first hand was wonderful. Things that I was struck by, obviously right now they don't really have much opportunity to turn those forests in the short term into any kind of reasonable income stream. In the cap and trade program of California, they are required to have species diversity. So this will not be a tree farm. And I think essentially it'll be three different species that they plant and have planted. Another interesting part of the program is that you find that the property owner is much engaged in preventing fire on the property. Particularly in the California program, if they start the fire themselves, it's very punitive for them and doesn't work out in their long-term interest. So you have an alignment of interest there to prevent fire, which I thought was really wonderful. But we are going to end up with a forest there that is a much older forest, but that they're still going to be eventually it'll be a working forest, and they'll be cutting trees every year in the future. And it's going to be a better forest for recreation and better forest for other species as well. And so I saw a lot of positives there. One negative that I heard about was that they spent $750,000 in the application process and the approval process with California. And I think if Oregon ever does this, there's a big lesson there in that really, if we had a similar process, only the very largest property owners would be able to participate. And so I hope if we ever do that, that we look carefully at trying to streamline that process. Finally, on another subject, I'd like to just share my thoughts around all the publicity that ODF has been getting and the fact that we've been portrayed in the press as the gang that couldn't shoot straight. And I think I'm going to go in a direction here where I think there's some shared blame that should be expressed out there. So I think I have a tradition of getting everybody mad at me by the things I say. But if you really look at this, you know, ODF definitely has some responsibility, particularly in terms of how and they have communicated the problem for some time now. That said, I think you also have to look at the other parties here. I think you have to look at the legislature. I think you have to look at the governor's office. And I think you have to look at stakeholders on both sides here, because we have quite a history here of not being able to get the funding that would have helped to head off this problem. And, you know, when the governor's office did not support a POP, they did that. Their reasoning was that the stakeholders were in such disagreement around how any money going to ODF should be spent. And that's happened now a couple of times in a row to legislative. So that we end up with the legislature not able and not willing to provide the needed funding that could have headed this off. So if our stakeholders on both sides had ever gotten together and found anything to agree about, they have a role in having led us into the current situation as all. So I think there's more than simply an agency that can't shoot straight here.
Thanks for that. Any other comments? We have comments, public comment. Nine folks have signed up to appear. We'll take you four at a time. And appreciate your summarizing your statements and especially to keep them under 3 minutes. But we have Ernie Nimi, Fran Caffaretta Coe, Sal Peralta, and Jill Bell to start. Appreciate your coming here today.
Thank you. My name is Ernie Nimi. I am president of Natural Resource Economics in Eugene. I want to talk to you first about three recent events. The first of these is research that's taken place over the last 3 years that documents the carbon dioxide emissions that result from logging within the state of Oregon. That research also indicates that the climate-related damages from the emissions that result from annual logging on state lands could exceed $13 billion a year, $13 billion. The second event occurred yesterday when 11,000 scientists said it is much, much worse than that. They said the climate crisis has arrived and is accelerating faster than most scientists expected. It is more severe than anticipated, threatening natural ecosystems and the fate of humanity. The third event occurred last November, when Oregon's Attorney General laid out the legal framework that plaintiffs can use to seek compensation when they, from an entity that sells a product that is then used to generate carbon dioxide emissions. That legal framework, I'm not an attorney, but it seems that legal framework could be directed at the Board of Forestry for selling timber and logging rights that then result in carbon dioxide emissions that create damages in excess of $13 billion a year. These events lead to three conclusions. One is, I believe it would be prudent for the board to not sell any timber at all until it has fully assessed the carbon-related damages that can result from that sale and the potential threat risk to taxpayers if plaintiffs seek compensation for those damages. The second recommendation conclusion is it would be prudent for you to suspend all logging right now until you have fully assessed these costs and these risks, given the comments from the scientists yesterday, and you have developed a reasonable risk management plan. The third conclusion is, if you do not take these steps, it would be reasonable for you to anticipate that at your future meetings, you will have Oregonians flooding this room and this building saying, how dare you? How dare you? How dare you? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Imason and fellow members of the Oregon Board of Forestry. For the record, my name is Fran Caffaretta Coe. I'm a certified wildlife biologist and the owner of a small wildlife consulting firm. My professional career focuses on working with landowners to intentionally manage wildlife for sustainable as part of sustainable timber harvest. Much of my work is developing and implementing biodiversity management plans for timber companies. I have written and helped implement wildlife and biodiversity management plans for my clients, and I'm excited to share that this represents over 500,000 acres in Western Oregon from the California border all the way on up to the Washington border. And so I get a little bit disappointed and a little bit frustrated sometimes when I come to these meetings and it feels like the tone is just that the sky is falling and that if we do nothing, that the Oregon's wildlife species that call our forests home are going to perish. And I'm just here today to offer an alternate view based on my years of experience working directly for wildlife and working forests. I spent my career working with landowners such as Lone Rock Timber, Justina Land and Timber, Greenwood Resources, and others. And I can tell you that we're making intentional decisions and implementing actions that benefit wildlife. And we do this all the time. We do it every day. For example, we retain and create snags for cavity nesting birds. We leave legacy trees for the many species of wildlife that rely on them. We are planting a variety of species and growing forests and habitat. We leave downed wood for small mammals. We complete fish habitat improvement projects. We work to remove barriers to fish passage. We intentionally create biodens that benefit bats. And we're doing this management in an intentional way. These examples only scratch the surface of the work that we're doing. And again, I'd just like to reiterate that that's over 500,000 acres just in the work that I'm involved in. And I just wanted to bring this to your attention today to shed light on the positive actions that are occurring for wildlife across the state. And I just appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Imason and members of the committee. My name is Sal Peralta. I'm a member of the McMinnville City Council and a board member of the Mid-Valley Council of Governments. I'm here today to talk about climate change policy. I appreciated Mr. Kelly's update speaking to the on-the-ground provisions of the California Carbon Trading Program, as well as the director's update outlining the board's interest in course correcting existing work plans and the increased focus on forestry's role in climate change policy. I'd like to encourage your agency staff and your board to consider whether the agency is taking full advantage of the statutory authority that's been granted to it by the Oregon legislature to address climate change, particularly with respect to policies that allow for the development and marketing of carbon sequestration offsets. One program in particular that I'd like to flag for your attention, which falls under the purview of this board, is the Oregon Forest Resources Trust. The Oregon Forest Resources Trust was created by the legislature in 1993 to help non-industrial private landowners establish and maintain healthy forests on land that had previously been forested. The funds intended to provide financial, technical, and related assistance to public and private landowners for the establishment and management of forest land for timber production and conservation purposes. But crucially, it's the first program in the nation to authorize the development and marketing of a protocol for carbon sequestration offsets. That's especially relevant today, I believe, given the failure of the previous legislature to pass new legislation related to climate change. Although the trust has this broad statutory authority, which is contained in ORS 526-700 through 526-775, which is included in the notes with my packet, Its implementation has been narrow in scope, primarily administering 200-year loans through a small fund with money specifically tied to that purpose. However, the trust has several statutory components that make it potentially a very useful vehicle for helping to move the state's climate goals forward. It has a separate segregated account from the general fund. It includes both a loan and a grant program. It's already authorized to regulate carbon offsets, and it's authorized to make agreements with both public and private entities. What it's lacking is funding. Because the trust has never been adequately funded, its core mission is tied to a program that's not very attractive to landowners, it's underutilized. And so I'd like to ask the board and the agency to review the statutory and administrative authority of the trust to determine the extent to which the current scope of the program could be expanded to better meet Oregon's climate policy needs. Specifically, I'd like to ask the agency to explore funding opportunities for the trust, particularly in the context of bringing in outside dollars for a grant program to address climate change through afforestation and reforestation. The basic idea here is that ODF seeks state support, either direct state funds for granting or more limited seed money to solicit private dollars for forest reforestation and afforestation and similar projects. I believe the statutory authority granted in the program would allow the state to take in funds for carbon sequestration without additional legislative authority. And I believe you could use this program to make it easier for jurisdictions like California that have set up carbon trading programs and for companies that are subject to environmental judgments or that just want to offset their carbon footprint to invest in those kinds of projects on a non-industrial private land in Oregon. I've had some preliminary conversations about this concept with a wide range of stakeholders, including environmental groups, rural community advocates, Treasurer Tobias Reed, and a diverse group of legislators, and I believe there's support for this approach, so I ask that you consider it. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Imeson, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board. My name is Jill Bell, and I'm here today to share with you information about the Oregon Women in Timber, known as OWIT, which is a nonprofit organization that focuses on forestry education and advocacy. I joined OWIT 1.5 years ago, and I'm currently the president of the Lane County chapter and the state secretary. My background is deeply tied to logging in the timber industry. I am proud to say that I'm a logger's wife, a logger's daughter, and a logger's sister. My personal background is in forest engineering, and I've worked in the industry for the past 16 years. Because of this, I'm very concerned about the future of our industry and want to make sure fact-based information is getting out to the public. My whole family is proud of what we do, and we want people to see the good in logging and active forest management. We have also been concerned about misinformation being provided to the general public by people who use emotion rather than science to talk about clear-cutting, logging, and forestry. This is why I joined OWIT and am active with the organization. One of the things that attracted me to OWIT is our interactive science-based forestry education program for K through 8th grade called Talk About Trees. The program is presented by experienced facilitators and offered free to classrooms throughout Oregon. The goal of the program is to encourage an awareness and appreciation for the value of trees and forests in our daily lives, including information about the protection, management, and conservation of the renewable forest. The Lane County chapter of OWIT just did a Forest Products Month campaign during October. As part of this campaign, we ran radio ads, had a Forest Fact Friday giveaway on the radio, we had members on talk radio shows, ran a social media campaign that had over 20,000 unique reaches, held mill tours where 12 University of Oregon students participated, and hosted a trivia night with Lane Families for Farm and Forest where over 20 people showed up. It was hugely rewarding to engage with our communities and educate the public about our love for the forests and our industry. As a lifelong rural Oregonian, I love the communities and landscapes where I have the privilege to work. The timber industry provides family wage jobs to people who, like myself, love to be outdoors. I can't even put into words the true passion and love for the land that foresters and loggers have. And I see that every day in my coworkers, my employees, my contractors, and my family. We, more than anyone, want to ensure working forests are around for the next generation, as my family has left the forest for my generation to steward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, all of you. Next, Anna Yarbrough, Amanda Astor, Melissa Thompson, and Kyle Williams.
Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board. My name is Anna Yarbrough. I'm a forester, a mom, an avid outdoors woman, and a member of the Lane County chapter of Oregon Women in Timber. Between me and my husband, I'm proud to say our family is 100% supported by Timber Dollars. We both work in the woods and spend as much time as we can outside of work with our son in the woods. For me, Oregon Women in Timber is an avenue to advocate for active forest management that supports families like ours. Families who not only depend financially on the timber industry, but also spend all their personal time recreating in Oregon's forests. Teaching our son and, through Oregon Women in Timber, the general public about the importance of natural forest cycles and the role that active management can play in those forest cycles is critical. We can actively manage our forests while protecting water quality, enhancing wildlife habitat, producing renewable wood products, and supporting rural communities and families like ours. These forests are our homes, our offices, our playgrounds, and for some of us, even our grocery stores. These forests and the timber industry provide a way of life that many of us can't imagine living without. Through Oregon Women in Timber and their educational programs, I'm working to help bridge the gap between families like ours and those who think walking on a groomed city park trail is getting out in nature. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board, thank you for your time today. My name is Amanda Astor. I'm a forester from Eugene. I hold a Bachelor of Science in both Forest Management and Forest Biology, a minor in Botany, and a graduate certificate in Forest Carbon Science, Policy, and Management. I'm also the secretary for the Oregon Women in Timber Lane County Chapter. As someone who works in the woods, and as a young woman who wants to have a family one day, I'm always thinking about the future. What will the community my child grows up in be like? What will there be a healthy economy? Will the community be safe? Will the schools be good? I also think deeply about the environment, climate change, and what my child's life will be like once I'm long gone. Thankfully, Oregon has trees. We have forests. Forests not only provide oxygen and remove carbon dioxide, our forests provide renewable wood products and family wage jobs. Working in the woods is not easy, often requiring back-breaking work and long hours when no one else is awake. So why do we do it? It's because we love our forests and we love our industry and we are proud of it. Our hearts and souls are put into what we do every day. It is our identity. Many of the companies working in the forest sector are small, family-owned businesses with razor-thin margins. As the board considers policies that affect their ability to survive, remember that Oregon's forest sector is made up of real people with real families who need real food. I also encourage members to recognize the climate benefits from constructing and designing with wood products. According to the American Forest Foundation, building with wood is better for the environment, it helps reduce energy consumption, and improves energy efficiency. Using engineered wood I-joists instead of steel joists results in 22 pounds of avoided greenhouse gas emissions for every square foot of floor. Oregon Women in Timber supports science-based policy and management. Actively managing forests also has climate benefits. According to Bruce Lipke of the University of Washington, the carbon in sustainably managed Pacific Northwest forests is restored at time of harvest. The forest remains carbon neutral because removals are set to be not greater than net growth. Lastly, a Dovetail Partners Incorporated report suggests forests do not accumulate carbon indefinitely. Older forests tend to have higher carbon densities than younger forests, but low or near zero rates of additional carbon sequestration as they reach maturity. In old forests where catastrophic losses are likely, active management can provide carbon benefits. A no-harvest strategy can mean missed opportunities for greater carbon mitigation over the long term and also increase the risk of loss. As members of the Board of Forestry, you can prevent this loss by supporting those of us who work in the woods, ensure our forest continues to sequester maximum amounts of carbon, and help keep forests as healthy forests for our children and future generations. Please consider this information moving forward, and thank you for hearing my public comment.
Thank you.
Chairman, excuse me, Chairman Imason, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board. My name is Melissa Thompson, and I'm here today to tell you all my why. I was born in Mapleton, Oregon, a town that epitomizes the very definition of rural Oregon, a town from which slogans like Timber Dollars at Work were designed. My hometown was built, funded, and ran for many years on money generated from the timber industry. Born the daughter of a mill worker and granddaughter of loggers and mill workers, my very first paying job was for the small sawmill in town. This sawmill, with its various logging operations and forestry operations, supported many working families from all the local towns and cities nearby. Some of my earliest memories in this life are the sounds of the mill operation, yarder whistles, and the smell of timber being milled and loaded onto trucks and trains to be delivered to destinations abroad. By the time I was in high school, the lines of misinformation regarding this industry were very apparent. I found myself often defending the industry simply because my fellow students were being told things that were either false or had been greatly exaggerated by extremists. The effects of environmental extremism were even then wreaking havoc on this once thriving community. It wouldn't be long before all the mills from the town I knew and loved were closed, taking with them countless jobs and revenue. To say it was devastating doesn't even come close. Now, as an adult, I am an owner of a small logging operation. Our belief for our company and this industry remains the same. Managed forests are and will always be crucial to the well-being of all. As such, the jobs in forest management and the timber industry have a unique opportunity to support working families as they did when I was a child. I joined Oregon Women in Timber as a way to further my ability to help educate others on the importance of proper forest management. I love the science-based information we provide to both children and adults alike. I look forward to working with this fantastic group of women as we continue to grow awareness. My hope for the future is that Oregon will continue to lead the country in sustainable forestry and active forest management. This will mean listening and learning and working as a team. Only this will ensure Oregon's forests will continue to thrive for generations to come. Thank you.
Morning, Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, members of the board. My name is Kyle Williams, and I serve as the Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. Fire season 2013 served as a significant marker in time as we talk about length and severity of our summers. Since then, our state has seen increases in average acres burned, dollars spent, impacts to our communities, and loss of valuable timber assets. Due to these severe impacts, over the next couple of days, you will undoubtedly hear about a significant need for a shift in the way we approach and deal with fire in our state. That we as Oregonians have a responsibility to address the increases in frequency and severity of fire on the landscape, and that in some cases, we should not be putting fires out. I would agree with all of these sentiments, save for the last one, depending on the time of year. But I think it's really important that as you move forward, you are provided with some context for where and what the problem is. This might come as a surprise, but the number of fires hasn't dramatically changed over the last 10 years. What has changed is the number of acres burned has significantly trended upward. Interestingly, fire starts are almost equal between private and federal ownerships over that same time period. This should make some sense, being that ODF and U.S. Forest Service protect roughly the same number of acres in Oregon, but that's where the similarities between private lands and federal lands stop when it comes to Oregon's forests. Did you know that in 2017, only 6% of the acres burned were on private lands? How about in 2018, the year of incredible smoke and destruction statewide, only 9% of the total acres burned were on private lands. And in the 10 years prior to the summer of 2019, only 10% of the forested acres burned have been on private lands. These numbers bear out what I know to be true. Fire on private and state lands are easier to put out. Part of the magic is simply the fact that ODF provides our fire protection. The department has a reputation as being the best wildland fire outfit in the world, and their success every summer proves that. But there's more to the story. Through a combination of deep commitment and investment in the landscape, private lands and landowners are engaged in a way completely unique to Oregon. We reduce fuels through harvest and active management of our lands. We salvage log and replant post-fire so that soils can be stabilized and snags don't leave a lasting legacy of danger to the initial attack crews. We invest heavily in our infrastructure and maintain these roads and fuel breaks throughout their lifespan. This gives our firefighters access when the fires are small and anchor points to safely engage them. All of these landscape features are critical to success. Because of active management, our ODF firefighters are able to safely and aggressively go after each and every fire start, and the difference in the numbers reflects that. In some ways, this creates an unfair situation when there's a fire burning on adjacent federal lands. You may have heard of the concept of picking the right ridge, not the next ridge. This refers to committing effort where the likelihood of stopping the fire is closest to 100%, even if that effort is several acres or even drainages away from the main fire. Unfortunately, more and more frequently, the right ridge is on private lands. In 2017, just under half of the acres burned on ODF protection came from fires originating on other jurisdictions. There's even more. Private landowners invest heavily in training, equipment, and early detection well beyond their statutory responsibility. A survey I conducted last spring of the OFIC members determined that through things like landowner-owned engines, heavy equipment, and fire-trained personnel, there's over $14.5 million worth of annual resource readiness value that we can bring to bear. This doesn't include the vast resources of our contractor base, who also respond and support ODF when the fire bell rings. Again, all this information isn't to pit ODF against the U.S. Forest Service or anyone else for that matter. The intention is to point out that fire seasons are long and painful for all of us, but there are differences in where these fires are burning and how these lands are being managed. Our private lands have proven that we can and should put out every fire, that active management can be a cure for the increase in frequency and severity, and that it can and should be accomplished safely and aggressively. Thank you for your time. Thank
you. Thanks, all of you, for coming today. And Bob Van Dyke.
Board members, for the record, Bob Van Dyke. I'm here today with some questions about the ongoing issue of the compliance audit from the Forest on the Forest Practice Act. As you know, you report regularly to the legislature on the key performance measure of compliance with the Forest Practice Act. And there was a compliance audit completed in 2017. And that audit has been the basis of reporting to the legislature, 96-97% compliance. Wild Salmon Center and the Oregon Stream Protection Coalition and some board members, I think, as well, all raised some questions about the validity of the study design and data analysis in that 2017 compliance audit. From our view, from our third-party review that we commissioned, the data is unreliable and shouldn't be reported on to the legislature. In fact, so far as we could tell, the proper report should be unknown because we don't have good data. It may actually be higher than 97%, but it may not. We just don't know because of the study design. I flagged this issue for you before your September 4th board meeting when the performance measures were in the consent agenda. There was some discussion about that. The impression I was left with was that the department was doing a look back at that 2017 audit, and if in fact they found that the study design was problematic, they would then address that. They'd caveat the reports or somehow acknowledge that there was some uncertainty with them. I've since heard from staff that there is not going to be any kind of backward-looking assessment, and the results are just going to be left as they are. So really, I'm here today asking for clarification of that and just underlying the point that if, in fact, that study is, in fact, invalid or not reliable, then the results, at least to the legislature, should be changed. Lastly, I would say that really, our main concern is looking forward as well from here. How should future studies be designed, et cetera? But we do want the record correct looking back. And I'm happy to answer any questions. I'll submit some written testimony and a copy of the performance measure graph to your staff.
Thank you. Yes, Brenda?
I'd just like to follow up on that if I could. I've asked several times about this issue, and I had the understanding that the report was going to be reviewed and that there would be an analysis done of the study design and statistical analysis used. I've raised questions about that quite some time ago, and I think Cindy has as well. So could we get clarification on what?
Yeah, I'm certain it was me that gave you that impression. And my staff said they were working with OSU StatNet, and it turned out they're working with that as a forward-looking thing. So I've asked staff to reevaluate that, and we're currently reevaluating the option for getting a past review.
Thanks for that. I appreciate that. I think it's really imperative that if there is an error in my assessment of this, the design and analysis is that there are errors, that there be some communication back to the legislature on that.
Well, and I would say initially back to the board, obviously, as well.
Sorry, yes, of course. Yeah, thank you.
I just had a lot of discussion over this topic. Clarified and communicated to us, to the public, and to the legislature.
Jim?
Great.
So, just to summarize this little aspect of this, we're expecting some follow-up report back from you, Peter.
We'll do.